On today's episode of the Return on Intelligence podcast, we're talking to my friend and former colleague, Sarah Devereaux, formerly from Google. Sarah has a 15-year history at Google in which she worked many functions in the learning space, from instructional design to running Google's peer-to-peer employee learning programs to executive development and the Google School for Leaders. In this episode, she shares insights from all of those different areas working at Google, as well as her life beyond Google, in particular focusing on women's leadership and some of the ways that women leaders can flourish and thrive in work and in life. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Return on Intelligence, our podcast for all things learning, development, and professional growth and personal growth. I'm super thrilled today to invite and host my friend and former colleague, because we used to work together at Google, Sarah Devereaux. It's been a little while since we've been at Google together, but I met Sarah back then, and I think, Sarah, you were running the peer-to-peer learning network at Google, as well as previously having run the instructional design team as part of the people development function. But everybody here is really in for a treat, because you have a very broad background. If I could just talk a little bit about your experience in instructional design, peer-to-peer networks of learning, employee learning, employee-to-employee learning. You had a job that I also held at some point at Google, which was leading executive development programs. You were a strategic leader for the Google School of Leaders, which was, again, senior development for the senior leaders at Google, and other strategic initiatives, including performance management, altogether about 10 years at Google. And then having moved on now to some other adventures, working through a sort of VC-backed startup environment, and now on to White Pine Leadership Collective, in addition to some other projects that we can talk about today. White Pine Leadership Collective being a learning and growth platform for women leaders, so they can lead fulfilling and enriching lives. Incredible and interesting body of work. So, Sarah, welcome to Return on Intelligence. So happy to have you here.
Oh, thanks so much, Rich. Gosh, it seems like a million years ago that we were riding the roller coaster, if I remember. California Adventure.
Yes. Right. So we were at an offsite, and we all got to ride these roller coasters. And I remember that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Kind of like a metaphor for life at Google and in tech. Yeah. And I think beyond that in working life in general.
It just kept spinning and spinning, didn't it?
Yep. Peaks and valleys, terrifying moments. Not sure whether they're terrifying or thrilling. Lots to learn. So lots of metaphors to draw from there.
For sure.
Sarah, tell us first of all, where you're joining us from, and then what you're working on these days.
Yeah. Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm joining you from often beautiful and today very rainy and wet, Ann Arbor, Michigan. So my husband and I are both from Michigan. We moved out to California in 2011, took a very brief stop in Colorado, and we've been back home outside of Ann Arbor for the last 2 years. And that kind of leads into one of the things that I'm working on. So we have a 20-acre farm that we are working on building and cultivating and hopefully turning into an actual business. And then I also do leadership coaching and strategic advisory for people and culture teams. So helping folks to kind of build sustainable and healthy practices for effective teams, as well as maybe unwind some practices that aren't super sustainable or healthy. White Pine Leadership Collective is my third business, and so focused on helping women leaders to live and work at their best, because why not? We do way too much, and we have so much of our energy invested in our jobs. We need to make sure that they're building our energy and not depleting our energy.
Amazing. So farming vegetables, animals, and helping people farm their lives, I guess.
Yeah.
It sounds like.
The amount that I have learned about leadership and about self-awareness and about just self-improvement through farming has been honestly like pretty bananas. It's been really crazy how much we've been able to grow ourselves, like just as people, by trying to grow things in the dirt.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it seems like an endless amount of things that we can learn about ourselves and how to just lead fulfilling lives and lead with impact, I think. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about and that might be of interest to our listeners is that if we go back to the work you did at Google, because you were there for the better part of, I'd say, pretty much a full decade, if I remember correctly, right? 15 years. Oh my gosh.
Oh, I couldn't believe it. When I left, I was like, that can't be right. It was just shy of 15 years, but
that's right.
I left right before my 15th anniversary.
Wow, right. Because now I'm remembering, right, because you had also, before I got to work with you there, when I met Sarah at Google, I was running executive development.
Uh-huh.
But before that, you had a career in sales training, if I remember correctly, and AdWords, helping people with like those functionalities from an upskilling perspective as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I started as a customer support rep. I answered emails. I was a triple chatter. And I used to answer the phone and say, thank you for calling AdWords. This is Sarah. How can I help you? And then I moved into training, literally because there were too many new hires. And the person who was running the Ann Arbor office at the time was like, you seem nice and smart and like you know what you're doing. Would you like to be a trainer? And I never really saw myself like sort of in a training or educational capacity. I always considered myself a salesperson. But then I just completely fell in love with it. And after the 3-month special assignment was over, I basically went into his office and I'm like, I literally don't care what you have me do. And I don't care how much you pay me. Please let me keep doing this job. I absolutely loved it.
Okay. So you kind of fell in love with training, development, that whole endeavor. And I guess that puts you on the trajectory you're on.
It's kind of kept going.
So you did some instructional design work and then led the team in that. In Google's learning and development function is called people development. And so you were leading the team in instructional design. And then interesting was then to move to this G2G or Googler to Googler employee network, learning network. So first of all, people might not be familiar with everything, what all that means, right? What does that mean, a peer-to-peer employee network of learning? What is a Googler and a Googler to Googler? So just could you walk us through what that model is?
Yeah, absolutely. I love talking about G2G. I always say that it was honestly the crowning jewel in my career at Google. So the G2G program was a volunteer network of folks like across the globe who were literally dedicating their time to help grow, develop, and teach and mentor their peers. So at the time, when I transitioned from sales training into leading G2G, it was a couple hundred folks, and that might sound like a lot, but wait for it. I'll tell you where we got to. But a couple hundred folks that were primarily focused on sales training, and primarily focused on new hire upskilling. And we took it and we decided that we wanted to create a machine that really could allow every Googler across all global offices to have access to learning and development. Being in the Ann Arbor office, I really didn't understand that there was a lot of learning and development like happening in different parts of Google. I figured it was just education reimbursement, it was new hire orientation, and that was kind of all there was, right? Because the satellite offices really didn't have a whole lot of opportunity. So G2G, the whole purpose was, we believe that learning at Google is a right, not a privilege. We believe that you should be able to develop yourselves no matter what location you're sitting in. And we can do it if we harness how phenomenal all of these people are who are already here, the knowledge of regular, everyday, right, Googlers. They were so smart and so well-intentioned. So we scaled up to about 11,000 people globally. We were represented in, obviously, virtually, but also in about 108 offices across the globe. I think there were only like 112. So there were only a few offices where we didn't have G2G representation. And at the time that I left Google, Over 85% of all training that happened at Google, whether it was one-to-one, whether it was virtual, whether it was an instructor-led, whether it was live instructor-led, e-learning, 85% of all learning that happened at Google happened through G2G. Like, that's how Google did learning. And during the pandemic, that's how it all continued, was through the G2G program.
So I'm sure people listening to this are, first of all, perhaps astounded as I am. I didn't actually realize it was that scope. Although the very thing that I run today, SIY Global, SIY was, I think, perhaps one of the biggest, we'll talk about that in a second, the biggest components of the curriculum that was being taught. But before we get to that, one of the things you said was a volunteer network of Googlers. So Googler is a Google employee. G2G is Googler to Googler. Googlers, teaching Googlers, as a volunteer network for learning and development. So when you say, can you define the term volunteer? This wasn't their day job, right? They weren't like 11,000 learning and development trainers who were intern employees. So tell us about that volunteer workforce, if you will. What motivated them? What enabled them? How did they get the air cover, the buy-in from their managers to do it? What outcomes did we see? Why and how did this all happen?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is a winding and circuitous path.
We got time.
You can go on here, Rich. So I'll start with the composition of the G2G network overall. So no, to your point, these folks were not full-time learning and development, you know, facilitators, instructional designers, mentors, coaches. These were software engineers and customer support representatives and direct sales account managers and VPs, you know, within marketing and engineering. We had folks all the way from some of the lowest levels at Google all the way up to SVPs that reported directly into Sundar who were participating in the G2G program as volunteers. And for some of them, they were doing it at a really small percentage, like 3 or 5%, right? For others, they were doing it more in a 20 or 30% capacity. So it all depended on what kind of support they could get from their leaders, from their organization, from their managers, and also what they were willing to do as part of their allocation, part of their official capacity. So is my manager willing to set aside time for me to work on this? Or am I just so passionate about this that I'm willing to do it in addition to my 100% full-time role? And when G2G first started, the latter was more of the norm. So people were volunteering for this thing and they didn't have approval. They didn't have set aside capacity. They were doing it on top of everything else. I remember I used to schedule meetings with the G2G communities around the world at like 8 or 9 or 10 p.m. Eastern, because so many of the folks that were volunteering in our West Coast offices had to meet after work because they weren't allowed to be doing it during work. So it wasn't always like this rosy fairy tale. We got to a point, however, where we were able to show through some pretty robust data and analytics that not only did people love doing this, but they were providing a huge amount of value to the organization. And we were able to put dollar signs behind it. And we were able to show that if you participate in G2G, like, it is a statistically significant fact. There is a relationship between G2G participation and higher performance and also higher engagement, better retention, and promotion. And if you're a manager who's participating in G2G, then your scores in terms of your employees and your team's happiness and your team's effectiveness, those also went up. So there was kind of this misconception out there that if you participated in G2G, that was going to take away from your core role, that it was going to take time away, it was going to take focus away. And what we proved by working with the people analytics team was that it didn't. It enhanced your core role. You're a better performer. You're a better asset to the company if you're allowed to participate in this program.
That's amazing. And that answers the with him, what's in it for me question for the person, their manager, and the organization. All those three different levels, it sounds like. And then it sounds so good, it's almost hard to believe. Why don't people do this more, you think?
Yeah. So I think that gets down to the motivation piece as well, which I want to touch on. But one of the things that we ran into that was really problematic, like right from the beginning. So I, you know, there was this huge reorg, you know, you remember from like your days at Google. For anyone who hasn't worked at Google or hasn't heard this before, there's this joke, you know, it's kind of like Michigan weather. If you don't like your team or you don't like your manager, just wait a hot minute. Like it'll change. I went through 17 reorgs in 14 and a half years. And I was part of a reorg and they were like, what do you want to do? Like you're no longer going to manage the instructional design team. I had just gotten everybody moving and everybody was shaking and it was great. And they're like, what do you want to do now? I said, I don't know. I wasn't expecting this. What do you want me to do? And they're like, well, you can go be an HRBP or you can go be a OD practitioner, organizational development. You'd be good at that. I'm like, yeah, all right. And then they were like, or you could run this program that's kind of failing right now. Like we've got this G2G thing and it's fine, but it's really stagnant. It's not expanding. So I was like, all right, cool. I'll go do that. HRBP and an OD practitioner, like roles I had done before. I was like, all right, you know, I don't want to do something I've done before. I want to do something different. So I got into the G2G thing. And the first thing I noticed, first thing, was that we were trying to control these people. Like there was so much like quality assurance and like hoops that you had to jump through in order to be accepted into the program. And you had to meet all of these criteria and all of these requirements to teach a 2-hour presentation skills course. Okay, let's put this in perspective. You had to be at Google for at least 2 years because apparently you could have never presented like outside of Google. No. Never.
Exactly. Well, Google.
you had to be at Google for at least 2 years. You had to have strongly exceeding expectations on your performance review for at least 3 cycles. You had to
The workforce. You had to be the top 10% of a very highly skilled workforce. Yeah. Okay.
You had to have explicit manager approval. You had to participate for at least 20% of your, you had to have 20% capacity available. And at the time, you had to go through a 3-day upskilling facilitator training that was only offered in Mountain View, but we're not going to give you any budget to travel here unless your manager approves it. So it was just the amount of requirements was really ludicrous. And a lot of it was because, you know, the sponsors of the G2G program wanted all of these assurances that people were going to do a great job. They were like, well, we need to make sure that we have quality assurance. We need to make sure that we're making it hard to get in here. We want people to know that they need to take this seriously in order for them to participate. There was even a portion in G2G's history where you were only allowed to participate if you had HRBP nomination. So not only did you have to do all this other stuff, but your HRBP needed to know you. I had no idea who my HRBP was in 2008. You know, like we were still the Wild West in 2008. So you had to be nominated and they didn't take volunteers. So you were like completely removing the magic. The magic is that
inevitable, right? Because of why? Probably because it's a what they call a CYA strategy, which is a cover your assets strategy.
Yeah. And this is a very roundabout way of me saying, like, leadership mistrust and fear is why this thing was not go. We had basically shown people that we did not trust them.
Yeah. Okay. So then what happened? So all these barriers, all of this like fear from leaders covering their assets, trying to make sure they're not right doing the wrong thing, you know, like performative, whatever you want to call it, right? This common stuff that happens in organizations. because you got this crazy thing. You're going to ask our employees to teach volunteer outside of their role. So how did you get it going? And this is a question perhaps that's broader for the audience too. Like, how might you get something like this going? How did you get it going?
Yeah. So similar question, two different answers. So the first one, how I did it, is not necessarily how I would recommend doing it. So at the time, I had a VP who was not supportive, but I had an SVP who was supportive. So Laszlo Bock loved G2G. And he got on Good Morning America and he was like, there are two things at Google that are the googliest of all the Google things, and it's TGIF and G2G. Like, he loved the program. But I had a VP who didn't, and I had to, you know, go through her and her leadership team. And she was very command and control. She was very like, we can't just trust them. We have to direct them. We have to make sure that we are calling the shots. So I kind of played that game globally, like for the offices that people were paying attention to. But at the time, L&D at Google was so under-resourced that there were plenty of offices that they weren't paying attention to. So nobody was really looking at Buenos Aires. Nobody was really paying attention to Chicago. Chicago was really small back then. Nobody was really paying attention to our Belgium office or Toronto. And Toronto was really close to Michigan, and I knew a lot of people. So basically, I played the game the way I was being told to play the game, and I executed the way I was being told to execute in the offices that I was, that people were paying attention to at the leadership level. And then these other offices where nobody was watching, I ran pilots, and I ran them for a year. And then I compared the numbers from the pilot locations with the numbers from the locations that they wanted more of this command and control structure. And the data just didn't lie. It showed people were more effective. They were happier. We were spending less money on learning and development because we had this amazing course and this amazing program of people that were offering this stuff. And it also showed that the quality, the ratings that people were giving to their full-time L&D trainers and also to the vendors that were coming in to facilitate were lower in a lot of cases than they were giving to G2G facilitators.
So the data didn't lie, but did you get in trouble? Like, how did this play?
Well, I'm pretty sure that that's one of the two promotions that I can point to that I lost.
Well, you lost. Okay. Good timing there. I thought you were going to say that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for being, you know, for you can cut this if needed. My grandfather, when I was little, always used to call me a shit disturber, like in a good way. And for being a shit disturber, for being, you know, for being a little bit too bold, perhaps. That's one of my two promotions that I'm pretty sure I lost for pissing somebody off.
All right. But you asked for forgiveness rather than permission.
I did.
And some experiments, compared them to kind of like the status quo. And the experiments seem to really suggest that this is a really impactful way to go.
And so it wasn't months of data. It was a year.
A year of data, yeah. What happened next? Where did he go from there?
So from there, it just exploded. So we had, at that point, we had scaled up to about 800 facilitators globally in the first year. In the second year, we went past 2,500. So we went from 800 to 2,500 facilitators in the second year. And then between year two and four, we hit 7,000. And just kept going. So when I left Google in 2021, 10 years of G2G, it went from a few hundred when we started in 2011 to over 11,000 in 2021. But I wouldn't recommend necessarily taking that approach to folks. What I would recommend is really trying to leverage your champions and help get a leader on board that understands why command and control and why systems of control instead of systems of trust are not as effective. And get a leader on your side who can really help to advocate with that wider executive audience. Honestly, if I'd been a higher level, if I'd been a little more senior and influential when I took over this program, because I was still like a lower level manager when they handed me this thing. If I had been a little more confident in my own ability to leverage Laszlo's support, I think I would have tried to use that connection more skillfully than I did.
Got it. Okay. So some good tips in there, though, like, you know, get find a champion, an advocate, work on cultivating that relationship as well. Let the data speak sort of the truth of the impact that is actually happening, which might be a way to maneuver around politics. Of course, the data don't lie. And in your case, the data was showing, as you said, tremendous impacts at all levels for the individual, the organization, for ROI and everything.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things, I've rolled G2G out in numerous organizations since leaving Google with some of my clients. And one of the things that I've noticed is that for clients where leadership is resistant, if you can at least run a pilot, like try to run it for a handful of courses, or try to run it for a particular, you know, function or department within the organization. And there's a lot of information available. I wrote about it on Google's Rework site. Laszlo included it in his book, Work Rules. There are a lot of resources out there. You can, of course, bring in an external expert. But there's a lot out there that's just available on how to implement this program internally and how to get the support that you need to do it.
Right, the peer-to-peer learning, yeah, network, exactly. And then what were the characteristics? And here it's a leading question. And of course, it's going to lead to some of the work that we've worked on together, because SIY, Search Inside Yourself. Also, we had Creative Skills for Innovation. These were, I think, the two biggest, most sort of compelling network topics that were being taught. What do you think made that the case? And why did people gravitate towards these things so much?
Yeah. Oh, great question. So yes, Search Inside Yourself and Creative Skills for Innovation, which was Google's design thinking and innovation course. They were neck and neck. It was like SIY was number one, and then CSI was number one. And then like you all would go back and forth in terms of the number of facilitators and just the sheer volume of programming being delivered. And then SIY did pull away. So I think CSI topped out in kind of the 200 range. And SIY had over 450 facilitators globally. And I think the reason that people gravitated so much to these programs was the impact that they were able to create with them. They saw the tangible results of being a better innovator. Right? Being better at design thinking and systems thinking and being able to think more creatively. They saw the impact of the mindfulness and the self-awareness practices that SIY was bringing to folks. I remember when we started talking about including SIY in the G2G program, and we were going to start creating, you know, the job description and like figure out what the interview process looked like and the application process. We had wait lists to attend SIY classes that were over 200 people long. People were waiting years to get kind of content. And the folks who had gone through the program, you know, I went through the program before it became a G2G-led offering. It was so clear when you finished the curriculum how like life-changing it was. It wasn't just career and work-changing, it was life-changing. And I think like as a graduate of SIY, you just wanted to figure out how you could get it to more people, because like work and the world and everything is gonna be so much better if we can just get this to more people. And so SIY exploded, I think, because of the impact and just kind of the benefit that it was able to create.
Yeah. Yeah, something we aspire to today. Just in full disclosure, I run SIY Global. I did not ask or didn't articulate all of those things, but SIY is this program that had that success at Google and now beyond Google. So really cool to hear about that. And the design thinking, of course, the creative skills for innovation, being things that really piqued people's interest and then drove that level of peer engagement across the organization. So tell us about then, you had many iterations after that. You worked at executive development programs, which is something I was familiar with as well. And then you were working at the Google School for Leaders. What are some of the key learnings from that time and those experiences?
Yeah, great question. So I think, you know, after I got back from my first maternity leave, and I was still leading G2G, and I think I had like this sort of realization that they didn't really need me anymore. I was looking at what my interim lead had done. And I was like, wow, you guys, like, this is awesome. Like, you did such an amazing job. Do you want to keep doing this job? And she was like, yes, I do. I'm like, this has been great. I've had such a great time. I'm like, you know, I did this for 5 years and it's probably time for me to do something else. Now, in full disclosure, I had also started thinking about what my life after Google was going to look like. And one of the things that I had a lot of ambition around was helping leaders and helping female leaders in particular. And so moving on to executive development, I had kind of two goals in mind. You know, one, I wanted to help change Google's culture or continue to evolve Google's culture from the top down. I'd been doing a lot of culture work from the bottom up for the first 10 years of my career. I wanted to see what kind of levers I could pull and what kind of influence and goodness I could provide from the top down, from the other direction. And then I also wanted to really understand what it was like to work and mentor and develop at the executive level. It wasn't something that I'd had a lot of experience with. I'd kind of run the gamut. I'd been on learning evaluation. I'd been on analytics. I'd been on instructional design and facilitation and community and peer-to-peer and, you know, open enrollment courses and e-learning. I'd kind of done everything except for executive development. So moved into that. And I think the few things that I learned, one, I learned a ton just about, you know, that level of instructional design and experiential design and the content around like systems thinking and complexity theory and adult development theory and self-awareness and situational awareness and like just all these phenomenal leadership concepts that weren't things that I was really familiar with when I started the job. But the thing that really stands out to me was just how lonely a lot of these leaders were and how tired and how discouraged. And they were really phenomenal human beings who had incredible intentions. And in a lot of cases, they had been given the biggest jobs of their careers and of their lives, and they had no idea what to do with them. And they just didn't know how to ask for help. They didn't know what skills they should really be cultivating. They were trying to do things that worked for them at a senior manager level as a director or a senior director as a VP. And the level of exhaustion and isolation was not something that I expected to find. I thought these people were all just going to be like top of their game and like, what could we possibly teach them? And the amount of need that existed for support at that level surprised me and also inspired me to continue to cultivate the next chapter in my career around serving that need.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they say leadership is a lifestyle choice. There is so many demand. There are so many demands, so much complexity to navigate, the stressors. Some people thrive in that environment, but it's not without its cost. And so how do you get support for the leadership tax, if you will, that comes along with that lifestyle choice? And so you were in executive development, then worked on strategic initiatives for the Google School for Leaders. And then you eventually moved beyond Google. So tell us about that transition. I know you also went through a sort of VC-backed startup and now also really focusing on perhaps your work with White Pine Leadership Collective. So could you just trace that arc for us, That'd be great.
Yeah, sure thing. So I ended up stepping out of executive development programs and working on strategic initiatives. And then also I was on the task force that redesigned Google's entire performance management system. And just really transparently, we were working on having our second baby. The job was really demanding and really stressful. And I had a miscarriage. And it was very painful, both emotionally and physically. And my husband and I made the decision that in order for us to, you know, be successful in having and expanding our family, that I was going to step back from management and leadership into an individual contributor role, at least in the short term. So I moved into the performance management revamp effort. And that was absolutely fascinating. I had never worked on something that was truly Google-wide before and was sponsored by the CEO and the C-suite that literally touched the lives of every single Googler. So that was incredible. And then when I got back from my second maternity leave, we were successful. We have two kids, awesome little girls. When I got back from my second maternity leave, first day back at the office, they fired me. So I was part of one of the very early pandemic layoffs. So I was laid off with about 60 other people across people operations within, I guess it was October. I think it was October. Yeah, October of 2020. And then oddly enough, I walked into this breakfast that I had scheduled with this friend of mine who wrote a book. And he's in Denver and I'm in Boulder. And he goes, "Hey, when you get back from mat leave, let's make sure we get together for a meal." So we had previously had this breakfast scheduled the week after they laid me off. And so I walk in and I'm like, "Aaron, you're not going to believe this. They fired me." And I'm like, "Honestly, I'm not all that surprised. I'm just a little surprised at the timing. But I have no idea what I'm going to do next." And so he was starting up this venture-backed pre-revenue SaaS startup focused on working agreements and participatory governance and consent-based decision-making. And he was like, "Oh my God, come work for me." I'm like, "Okay, what am I going to do?" He goes, "I don't know." He goes, "Just come work for me and then we'll figure it out later." So I ended up working 50% for him at this organization called Murmur. And it was incredible. So Aaron Dignan was the person that hired me, good friend of mine. We're having breakfast next month, actually. But yeah, he hired me at Murmur and I learned a ton about go-to-market and building a software solution from the ground up and about venture-backed startups, which I had no exposure to before. And it was absolutely fascinating. And after about 2 years, I wasn't really learning anymore. I had been doing, my leadership and my learning and development work, in the other 50%. So I was working part-time for Murmur, part-time for myself. And I was realizing that my energy was really much more so in that leadership and learning and development space. So I thanked everyone for all the fish. And I left in January of 2023. But yeah, it was a great move and it was a great transition. But, leaving Google after 15 years was hard. Like, even though I was ready, like my shelf life, like I had expired, Rich, like a solid 4 years earlier.
Sure. But thank you for all the fish. Love the reference. So probably you gathered a lot of fish at Google through your experience at Murmur, which leads you to today. It really, from what I know of White Pine Leadership Collective, you're integrating a lot of those lessons specifically for women leaders to live enriching lives. But why don't I let you tell it? And share just a little bit about the work there and the time that we have left.
Yeah. So White Pine Leadership Collective is one of three businesses that I have. So We have our farm, which we have incorporated into a full business. So Canna Hill Farm for our canna lilies. We do some flower farming. I have 1,500 rhizomes to get into the ground next week. So that'll be a fun and dirty job. And then I also do Third Coast Coaching, where I do leadership coaching, as well as strategic advisory for people and culture teams. But then, yeah, the White Pine Leadership Collective thing was really born out of this really just serendipitous connection between me and two other former Googler women. We didn't even know each other inside of Google terribly well. Nikki Patterson, she and I had at least heard of each other. We'd kind of worked on similar teams, but we weren't really connected very much. We'd maybe spoken, you know, a handful of times in 15 years. And then Stacey Kulongowski, she actually joined the Ann Arbor team right as I was leaving and heading to California. So she and I never overlapped at all. And Stacey was leaving Google, and everybody kept saying, oh, Sarah, have you talked to Stacey K? Stacey K is leaving Google. I had like five conversations with people that kept telling me, oh, you really should reach out to Stacey K. Did you hear? I'm like, who is Stacey K? I have never heard of this woman, and everybody thinks I know her. And at the same time, people were saying the same thing to her. Hey, if you're looking for advice on starting up your coaching business, or you're looking for advice on just life after Google, talk to Sarah Devereaux. Have you reached out to Sarah Devereaux? And Stacey had no idea who I was either. So our emails like crossed in the same week, reaching out to each other. We sat down at a coffee shop, 45 minutes quickly turned into 3 hours. And we realized that one, we were both really passionate about helping women leaders who perhaps had been told that they weren't enough at some point in their career or life, or perhaps had been told that they were too much. I was often told that I was a little aggressive, I was a little assertive, I was a little gritty, and maybe I should tone it down a little bit. So we realized that we had this common passion to do something to help women that fit this profile. And we both knew Nikki Patterson. Stacey had actually worked with her, you know, a bit more than I had. And we had both connected with Nikki just recently. So we all got together, and 3 months later, we had a curriculum for a 2.5-day women's leadership and transformation workshop, which we're running our second cohort in just a couple of days. And we also had a business. So we decided to form White Pine Leadership Collective. And we do these open enrollment workshops. We do one-day events in various locations. So far, primarily in the Midwest, but we're looking at Salt Lake City and Phoenix and maybe heading down to New Mexico, in addition to kind of the Detroit and Chicago and Indianapolis area. And then we also do individual and team coaching, as well as running custom workshops focused on women in leadership and working and living at your best for our corporate clients.
Amazing. Wonderful. Well, it is such a joy to hear. And hopefully, you know, the participants here listening today also were able to just hear in your arc an amazing journey as a learning leader, and facilitating the learning of others, helping the others be their best. So I can't thank you enough, my friend, for joining this conversation. It's really great to reconnect with you. Wishing you all the best. And anyone who's listening, you'll be able to find information about Sarah's work, you know, our work as well at SIY in the links that will be part of this podcast, as well as more on absorb.com. So thanks for being with us today. And for everyone who is on this learning journey, as we all are, love to say onward. So thanks again, Sarah.
I really appreciate you having me. And I really appreciate the work that you all are doing at SIY Global. I think that I'm sure we'll find a reason to do something together in the future.
Yes, I imagine so. Highly likely. All right. Thanks a lot, my friend. Thanks, everyone. Have a good day.